This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of December the 7th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. As you no doubt were reminded on Giving Tuesday last week by the flood of charitable solicitations in your mailbox and email inbox, we are deep into the season for sharing. But Giving Tuesday is an invention of the internet age, of course. Gift-giving has its roots in the pagan rituals that preceded Christmas and subsequently were folded into the Christian holiday. It's one of the main themes of the Christ story, as the Magi brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And at the very least, many of us wish to avoid the fate of Marley's ghost by investing in the well-being of our communities. And Uncle Sam nudges us in that direction by offering tax deductions for charitable giving, allowing us to reduce our taxable income. Beyond all that, the world doesn't give us much instruction on how to be effective givers. I've always wondered whether it would be better to concentrate on one or two groups instead of spreading charitable dollars in many directions. And can I be a more effective giver if I try to tackle a very specific need for an organization or a project instead of dashing off a check to its general fund? And of course, I usually wonder if I'm giving enough, as if there could be a standard for this kind of thing. To be sure, charitable giving can be very confusing. So for this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast, I've brought up these questions with IBJ columnist and personal finance guru, Pete Dunn, aka Pete the Planner. Here's our conversation. I am pleased, as always, to welcome back to the IBJ Podcast virtual studio, Pete Dunn. How was your holiday?
So far, so good. We're on a run of holidays, as you know. I don't know if you've seen the calendar, but so far we're good. Turkey has been consumed. Now we're just waiting to open gifts that none of us need.
Are you off for the month? What's going on?
No, I just, it's a mindset, Mason. It's a mindset.
Oh, okay. So I'm not getting in your way with this podcast. It's okay, right?
No, I'm excited to be here. This is putting the cap on my day, and I'm very excited by it.
So here's a topic that came up over Thanksgiving. So my wife and I are talking about charitable giving. There's a giant pile of solicitation letters by our front door. Giving Tuesday was this week. I have never seen so many urgent pleas for extraordinary giving. In fact, it was a Giving Monday with all the groups that are like, hey, we're going to cut ahead in the line and we're going to ask you for money now, which is completely legitimate given the pandemic. And then to top it off, my wife is now on the stewardship committee at church. Ooh. So there's a level of expectation that goes along with that. So we basically put together a list of questions for you.
Excellent. I mean, by the way, it's so important to note that I am not an authority on charitable giving, although I do have some thoughts about money.
That's great. You're a smart guy about money, and that's what I want.
Okay.
And these are not all about, you know, numbers and percentages, especially when we're talking about charitable giving. I mean, money is not just money. It's, you know, a statement of your personal values. You know, so feel free to put on your financial planning hat, but also your money psychologist hat.
Sure.
And your money ethicist hat.
I'm into that.
Okay. And I'm going to hit you with the hardest question first.
Okay.
How much should I give to charity annually, Pete?
I will start by saying there are two economic resources that all of us have, money and time. And there are times in your life in which you have more money than time, and there are times in your life when you have more time than money. And I think this is an incredibly difficult period to understand which you have more of. And most importantly, Mason, I'm not sure your time really matters right now. If you had time to give to charity, I think the Giving Tuesday emails doesn't say an urgent plea for your time, Mason. It says an urgent plea for your funds. So under normal conditions, I think you have to allocate time and money to the things you care about. Otherwise, your community is not going to be what you want it to be. You're just always expecting someone else to help. In this regard, it's about change, my man. It is about cold, hard cash.
Yeah. I know that you in the past have suggested 5%. Is it 5% of your income or 5% of your take-home pay?
5% of your take-home pay. Because, you know, it's funny, when I make budgeting charts for a living. Why? Well, I'm a tedious person, Mason. But I have budgeting charts and graphs and pie, whatever. to budget off of your gross income for anything other than retirement plan contributions doesn't actually make any sense, right? Because you and I spend our take-home pay. So to make people do the conversion when most Americans are terrible at math anyway, doesn't make sense. Your take-home pay is something you're familiar with. You know, maybe you get paid a couple times a month, you add up those two deposits, and oh, there's your take-home pay. Just take 5% of that. That's pretty easy to do. So that's why we make that an approachable number. Now, the natural question that's going to come, and you brought it up because your wife's on the stewardship committee, at what part does faith-based giving come into this? You can even look at the tithe. The tithe, in my opinion, not a tithing expert, would come out actually off the gross income as dictated by several church organizations. So that is to say, if tithing's your thing, it is 10% of your gross income. That 5% maybe for the secular folks.
Mm-hmm. You know, what our church has done in the past is kind of suggested a different percentage every year.
Really?
Yeah. One year, a guy got up and said, you know, we want you to increase your giving by 60%.
60% off of whatever your percent.
60% of what it was before.
That sounds like it works 100% of the time, 60% of the time.
You know, there was dead silence in that room. I'll tell you that much. I think maybe this year it's maybe more like 10. I think people are beginning to catch on that people are really struggling financially. So I'm saying that even your giving for church, you know, is up to you. And for this discussion, at least, your church is not telling you to give X amount of money.
I will say, and I know this, the topic of this is not faith-based giving, and I certainly do not want to go down that path too far, but that's much more complicated than nonprofit giving, because you've just got a whole other element to it that brings in a lot more emotion and feeling in, well, the G word.
Yeah, but when we're budgeting, or when we attempt to budget, you know, we are thinking in terms of, well, if we're giving $4,000 to church, that leaves us X amount of money for not-for-profits. So it's relevant.
It's true. And look, I'll tell you, maybe the simplest way to get our heads around this conversation is to just step back and think about all the nonprofits that touch your life and touch the things you care about and touch your community. And that if those nonprofits didn't exist anymore, and I've already seen some close here in the last 10 months, what would the impact be? And I think that's how you can start figuring out your battle plan for the end of the year of how you're going to do your best to touch other people's lives. Because Mason, it's not like we have an infinite amount of money to spread around. We are going to have to choose a couple of organizations that we really need to see stick around.
What if I'm really struggling this year? Obviously, a lot of people are. Is it okay to give myself a pass on charitable giving? Should I feel guilty about that?
No, you should not feel guilty about that. Every time I've been on during the pandemic, we have to acknowledge the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room is there are three groups of people in America right now. There are people who have been greatly impacted financially by COVID-19. That's about 25 to 30% of Americans. There are people, 55 to 60% of Americans, the second group, the majority group, who've not been necessarily significantly impacted financially. However, they don't have stability. They don't have objective financial stability. And the third group are people who are stable and have not been impacted. That's 10%. So I will say this, if you're in the third group, yeah, hey, look, with great power comes great responsibility. I believe Spider-Man's uncle said that, right? So we've got to deal with that. If you're in group one, there's zero expectation. If you've had your income decrease by 25% or more in the last 10 months, I think there's very little expectation that you contribute to nonprofits trying to survive. In the second group, it's such a big range, Mason, that I think it's just a case-by-case basis.
Now, one of the obvious, super obvious benefits for charitable giving is the tax deduction, or at least the potential for a tax deduction. You know, certainly not-for-profits want you to consider that. For folks who aren't familiar with that, can you just briefly explain what that means? How do tax deductions work for charitable giving?
Well, I'll tell you this. Me explaining tax policy on a podcast is exciting as it sounds. So this all changed with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Okay, so colloquially, which I always struggle to say that word, yet I try, that's the Trump tax cuts. Okay, so what happened is that the standard deduction increased on people's taxes. So it significantly changed how people file their taxes. Not as many people were filing itemized deductions. Okay, so this impacts tax strategy. It impacts what people give to charity. For instance, the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center estimates that the Tax Cut and Jobs Act shrunk the number of households claiming an itemized deduction from 37 million households to 16 million households in 2018. So that is to say, people used to itemize because they would give so much money that those itemized deductions would outpace the standard deduction. But then since they increased the standard deduction, fewer people itemize, which theoretically would mean fewer people push themselves further to give. And the theory here was that there would be less charitable giving under the tax Trump cuts. Now, fun theory, but it turns out in practice, that wasn't the case. 2019 was one of the most generous years on record, even taking into account the new tax policy.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's actually interesting to know.
I like that you say it's actually interesting because everything else I've just covered, modestly interesting.
Sorry. I use too many adverbs when I talk, so that's...
My wife and I were having this conversation. Is adverb use lazy? Because as a writer, I'm like, God, wow, that's like 35 adverbs in this thing. What am I doing?
You know, my son has picked up on it. You know, it's amazing to hear a five-year-old like throw adverbs into the middle of sentences.
Yeah.
Like, I generally like broccoli.
That's really cute, though. It's worth the
cuteness. Yeah. So here's how I understand this. Tell me if I'm wrong. So let's say I'm a single guy. I make, whatever, $75,000 a year.
Sure.
Right now, the standard deduction for me under the current tax code is $12,400. If I gave $10,000 to charity, you know, I could say I want to deduct that, but that's not as much as the standard deduction. So I would want to take the standard deduction, assuming that's the only deduction.
More or less, yes, that is correct. And again, without me being, it's not Pete the Planner CPA.com. So yeah, more or less, that is correct.
Right. So, I mean, the basic concept here is that if I give enough money to charity, I can subtract that money from my income before I apply a tax rate to figure out how much money I'm going to give.
Yeah, right. It reduces your tax burden. And that, especially at year end, especially with the advent of Giving Tuesday emails, that was that whole feeling of like, hey, it's year end. Let's get that tax bill down by giving to our community. I've found that insincere at best for well over a decade. And I don't say that judgmentally, although it certainly sounds pretty judgmental.
Really?
I find that, I don't know, at least the people I know are not giving to charity for tax reasons. It's because they have a cause that they believe in enough, and they realize from a liquidity standpoint, they can handle that expenditure. They're not then going to their accountant and going, all right, so $67 more to the Little Sisters of the Poor next year, that's going to help me. Like, no one really does that.
What are the benefits of charitable giving to me beyond the tax deduction? Emotional, metaphysical, intellectual, maybe other financial benefits we haven't mentioned already?
I'll say this, and I want to talk about my charitable giving because it's the only example that is close to me, right? And I'm not going to get into specifics, but I tend to gravitate towards scholarship style charitable giving, right? I like to fund scholarships. That's what I personally like to do. I'm reconsidering the prudence of that in the environment that we're in right now. Like right now, it's not that kids don't need scholarship. It's not that you know, first generation college students should stop going to school. I will continue to do that. But I'm also in this environment, not moved to increase those contributions right now. I'm looking for other things that have a more direct and immediate need within our community. The idea of giving to a food bank is a lot more appealing to me right now than finding another scholarship to fund. And so I think if you have a personal connection to your giving, you take pride in seeing how your giving impacts your community, it makes a huge difference. And that's something I learned several years ago, and I've really enjoyed that. But Mason, to my point, if I want to have an immediate impact right now, I can't wait for some kid to go to school, to graduate, to do something great, and feel like I had a part in that. I need to get money into the hands of the organizations that are serving our community right now. And that's how I'm personally feeling right now.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ podcast, and we're speaking with Pete the Planner about charitable giving.
In the past, I've kind of driven my wife crazy by, you know, giving a little bit to a group in May and giving another little bit to a group in June, and then, you know, getting wild hair and giving a lot of money to some group in July. And then at the end of the year, I got all these mailers and I've got to get them all together, you know, so we can at least give them to our tax guy. Do you think that it is better to have a strategy at the beginning of the year and try to stick to that?
I don't think there's anything wrong with the way you just described. And because I find that to be heartfelt, right? You are moved in the moment. You make a decision based on your resources. And I'm getting too weird here. That's beautiful. I think it's great. I will say many people who view that they have a charitable giving plan don't do it that way. They have a structured amount that they commit to at the beginning of the year. I'm going to just use big round numbers here. Let's say you make your take-home pay somehow equals $100,000. So that means you're going to give $5,000 a year to nonprofits. You'd give, what, $416 a month? And that's what it would look like. Or it'd be $1,250 a quarter. Now, usually what you've just described as your method, take that and combine it with the method I've just described, and that's what you generally find for people who have a charitable giving plan. They will both feel moved in the moment at like a gala or some cause, and they will also have a structured policy that is more tax deduction driven.
Let's say I'm a young professional and I am inspired to give back to my community, but I am just overwhelmed with the number of not-for-profits, and I don't know how to do it right. I feel like maybe I'm going to make a mistake. Can we give that person some advice for getting started?
Yeah, I actually was having a conversation with my in-laws the other day, and my mother-in-law brought up something that was very important to her. And she said, "Do you know anything about this organization?" And I said, "I don't, but give me a second." Went to Charity Navigator, right, which is the website, and read about it. Turns out it was a highly rated, well-respected charity. And I said, "Hey, look, fiscally, seems like a pretty reasonable place." So I think a website like Charity Navigator, where you can avoid the nightmare of donating money only to find out that all of the money is going to the executive director's car payment, right? Like you can kind of avoid that. The other thing is make sure that even the gift you're giving means something to you. Like I like the idea of, hey, that is my bench on this nature trail. And it's not necessarily a vanity gift. It's that you're connected with something tangible. And that's meaningful to you. I think giving to the general fund obviously is pretty nice for the nonprofit itself because they can make those decisions. But if you need a little extra motivation, picking something specific is good. And then Mason, call the executive director, talk to someone on the board. And I know they're inundated right now with stress, but trying to understand their cause will connect you to it in a more authentic way, I think.
I think you kind of grazed up against my next question, which was how do I get away from feeling like I'm doing checkbook giving, you know, or checkout aisle giving? I would guess it would be more meaningful to me if I could do something more personalized for the organization.
Yeah, this is interesting, right? Because it forces you to just really ask yourself, like, what do I care about? Like, maybe was there a moment in my life where an organization was able to step in and help me or step in and help someone I care about? And then you can find an organization that does that sort of thing. Now, I told you my affinity for funding scholarships. My wife doesn't share that same affinity, and nor should she, right? And so when we discuss the things that we care about, you take that into account. But to your earliest question of, hey, let's say you're a young single professional, how do you get started? I think it's almost tougher to get started on your own because you have no one to bounce these questions and ideas off of. I came to really dislike reactive giving. When other people would come to me like, hey, I'm running a 5K. Can you sponsor every step I take for 35 cents? I was like, first of all, thanks for making me do the math because I do love math. Second of all, it's like, why? I don't care. I like you. That's great. Congrats on getting off the couch. But I don't want to do that. And I felt like in my mid 20s, that's all there ever was. Every other person raising money for something else. And I was just going, oh, okay, okay. And then that really drove me to have my own plan without getting super weird and really incredibly soapboxy here. I think you've got to decide what you want your community to be. And then you've actually got to do something, and reactively giving to everyone else's causes doesn't really lead to that.
So that would, what you're describing is proactive giving then.
Not oh reactive. Yeah. Yeah. Proactive everything. I'm Mr. Pete the Planner. I mean, come on. It is in the name, Mason. No, look, it's no secret. I'm a tedious person. If I'm going to go to a restaurant 2 weeks from now, I'm looking at the menu right now. I'm proactively choosing my meal. Proactive everything. I think proactive giving, though, will make you feel the way you always want to feel. You know, when you go to a charity auction, which I happen to MC a few of these things, you find someone's like, oh, hey, there's a barrel of bourbon I can buy for $780. And while that's neat and you get something out of it and probably a headache later, it's not the best type of charitable giving, because how much does it actually mean to you? It's great. I'm glad you did it. But there's a better way. It's a better way to connect yourself with your community.
On the topic of, you know, my machine gun scattershot way of giving, is there such a thing as having a gift that is too small? Like, no. Is it better to give like a big hunk of money to an organization or spread it around? Like, if I have $3,000 budgeted this year for charitable giving, will my money have more impact if I give one gift of $3,000 or 30 gifts of $100 each?
I think it could be argued both ways. I would say this. The frequency of what you give, I don't know if it's as important as to how many organizations you choose to support, right? If you give $100 to 30 different organizations, cool, and it's great, generous, as opposed to $3,000 to one or $1,500 to two. I think that's probably the better move. And then, you know, here's the tough part. This is the Giving Tuesday email thing. They give you giving thresholds on these emails. Are you going to support us for 250 or 1,000? And they're always arbitrary numbers that just happen to be round. But sometimes, every once in a while, those marketers within those nonprofits really think it out and they say, you know what, here's what this $3,000 does. It feeds 15 kids for 3 weeks. It provides books for this. And you're like, yeah, okay, I want to do that, right? That's what I want to do. When you give $100 and you know it's just $100 going to this or that, it's, again, tough to connect that you're making a difference. But no gift. I sound like I'm an infomercial. No gift is too small. Like, no gift is too small.
Well, here's my concern based on personal experience.
Okay.
So for a few years, I was giving like $100 a year to a not-for-profit that's just concerned with environmental issues. Mm-hmm. And that was maybe 10 years ago. I'm still concerned with environmental issues, but this particular organization, you know, my priorities changed a little bit on strategy. And so I stopped giving to this organization. Every year since then, they have sent me mailers multiple times a year and a ridiculous amount of swag every year, like calendars and tote bags and other branded items, as if they wished to guilt me into giving them more money because now I have a calendar. Have I now cost them more money than I actually gave in the first place because they're sending me all this stuff? It seems like $100 was not really worth it.
Man, I'm sorry. I'm about to give a tough guy answer, and I'm not like a tough guy. You know me. But that's on them, man. That is poor donor management on their part. If they've not seen the trend shift and adjusted their marketing spend, that's on them. Here's the other fact of that. A lot of times those are products, byproducts of reactive giving. For a while, I was getting real involved with like social media giving projects where we get a bunch of people on social media to donate this amount of money for each Colts point or each interception the Colts throw or something like that. And then the money would go to the community. And that was a lot of fun. And I'll tell you, we raised a ton of money. We even got Jim Irsay involved once. I mean, it was a lot of fun. But oftentimes, those are organizations that you choose to care about in the moment, and then you get their emails and their mailers and all of this news continuously because you're on their mailing list. And then you hope they figure out sooner rather than later that it was just a thing and you're not necessarily connected to it because you don't want them to waste money on it, like people sending you swag.
There was one thing about deductions that I think we wanted to cover, and that is specific to the CARES Act. Tell me if I'm wrong here. Even if I take the standard deduction, I can still deduct $300 because the federal government still wants me to give to not-for-profit organizations.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The CARES Act said another $300, whether you take the itemized or standard deduction, is allowed for charitable contributions. And I think if you can, you should take advantage of that. The other thing is you could just talk to your friends or family and maybe all find a cause for that $300 that you may theoretically give. Another part of the CARES Act that's worth noting is that qualified charitable distributions up to $100,000 from IRAs are still available in 2020. I need to explain this to you in like 30 seconds. Here's the deal. Typically, when you are a retired person or someone is who of retirement age and you get to 70 and a half, the age 70 and a half, you have something called an RMD, which is called a required minimum distribution. And you have to pay tax on that withdrawal out of your IRA. So there is also something to offset that called a qualified charitable distribution, which basically says, well, I'll just take this money you're forcing me to take out of my account and I'll just give it to charity. That way I don't owe tax on it. Well, this year, because of the pandemic, there are no RMDs. People that are 70 and a half and older don't have to make required minimum distributions because the government's saying, hey, just keep your money. Things are no good. However, you can still make a qualified charitable distribution and receive tax relief for that. So that's a very esoteric thing. A few people who just heard that are like, all right. And the rest of people have the same look on the face as you do right now.
You may have already covered this, but what is your strategy this year? You mentioned that you had previously been more interested in funding scholarships. Have you basically figured out, you know, what your giving is going to look like for this year?
By this year, do you mean year end 2020?
Or year end 2020, yeah.
A couple different things. So instead of giving client gifts to our corporate clients this year, we donated a big chunk of money to a food bank. All right. So we did that. We also have another big group of gifts that we typically give that we chose to support a local business by buying from that local business. All right. So that's not exactly charitable, but it is still community driven. And it is likely that we will do a chunk of giving as we approach year end and find something that we think, it's not that they're worthy. A lot of places are worthy, but that captures our interest. And to your point, Mason, it is quite possible that we reconsider our giving strategy in 2021 as we still try to figure out what this economy is going to look like and where in our local community needs our most help.
Anything else you want to say?
I would say there's just no wrong way to give. I mean, we've talked about better ways to give, but if you're giving right now, that's great. And it's appreciated. I think to a lot of your questions are, is there a way to get more out of giving? And I, like everything in my life, I think a proactive approach and really thinking it through of you know, maximizing your impact by having a bigger connection to it, I think that's the way you do it. I think reactive giving, if it's all you've ever done, you will be pleasantly surprised with the other approach.
Shoot, that means I have to figure out how to plan things.
Yeah, yeah. If there's a reason, the planner is not alliterative with Mason. Mason, nope.
There's a reason why I'm a journalist is because I just have daily deadlines. Well, great. Well, thank you so much for sharing.
Always pleasure. Let's get through this thing. Let's keep it going. Let's see what happens at the end of January, early February in regards to stimulus and how we restart this economy. And I think we'll have a lot more to offer then.
Right on. Well, I can't wait for that.
My thanks again to Pete Dunn. Before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to point out some of the top stories in this week's print edition of IBJ. The city of Carmel is the latest Indiana community trying to leverage its waterways to offer businesses cheap and plentiful liquor licenses. Kirk Christian has more on Carmel's plans to establish 4 riverfront districts, and he checks in with other communities to see how this strategy has played out. Also in this week's issue, Mickey Shuey explores how city tourism officials could juggle the conventions and events set for 2021 in order to make room for hosting the entire NCAA men's basketball tournament this spring. And Sam Quinn outlines how the Indianapolis City-County Council hopes to move the needle on food insecurity by taking a more aggressive approach to tackling food access and equity issues. Again, you can see these stories in this week's print edition of IBJ and, of course, online at ibj.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to ibj.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.